a senior member of the Taliban has said that the group seeks good relations with Afghanistan's neighboring countries, including Iran, under an Islamic emirate. The head of the World Health Organization tells the Olympic authorities the world is failing to stop COVID-19 as the delayed Tokyo Games kickoff in Japan. And France accuses Turkey of a provocation after Turkish Cypriot authorities reopened the abandoned Cypriot resort town of Arosha. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour, senior member of the Taliban has said that the group seeks good relations with Afghanistan's neighboring countries, including Iran, under an Islamic emirate. Khair Khawa said the Taliban is strengthening ties with Iran, quote, day by day to resolve problems since this approach serves the interests of both nations. He noted that the Taliban and neighbors of Afghanistan need each other in every way. He said, therefore, regional governments should join hands and cooperate with each other, pointing to the Taliban's deal reached with the U.S. last year. Khair Khawa reiterated that all foreign troops must leave Afghanistan. Khair Khawa said there was no secret agreement with the U.S. about the pullout of foreign soldiers from Afghanistan. He said the U.S.-led forces failed to establish security in Afghanistan 20 years after the invasion of the country. The deal was made during the term of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Foreign forces have now largely left Afghanistan, and the remaining ones will go home by September 11th. The Taliban have launched a nationwide offensive and taken control of many regions. The full interview with Khair Khawa will be broadcast later today and also in the next few days. The pandemic delayed Tokyo 2020 Olympics kickoff in Japan amid concerns about a rising number of infections in the city. The world's largest sporting event got underway with a softball game in Fukushima behind closed doors. The Tokyo Olympics, which will formally begin with Friday's opening ceremony, will be held largely without spectators to minimize the health risks. The Japanese capital is already under a state of emergency following a surge in coronavirus cases, 79 of those among people accredited for the games. The World Health Organization chief backed the event. However, he said the world is failing to stop the pandemic and criticized G20 economies for their poor efforts in this regard.
Instead of being deployed widely to quell the pandemic on all fronts, they have been concentrated in the hands and arms of the lucky few, deployed to protect the world's most privileged people, including those at lowest risk of the severe disease, while the most vulnerable remain unprotected.
The WHO chief said out of more than 3.5 billion globally administered vaccine doses, 75% have been in just 10 countries. He said in low-income countries, only 1% of people have received at least one dose, compared with more than half of people in high-income countries. The coronavirus pandemic has so far killed more than 4 million people around the world. Political commentator Seijiro Takeshita says most of the people in Japan want the Olympic Games to be abandoned or postponed due to a new wave of the coronavirus.
We were having a big welcome in regards to this Olympics, especially after the big success of 2019 Rugby World Cup. But unfortunately, I think many people are backing off. In fact, 80% of the Japanese public do not want this to take place, or at least be abandoned, or at least postponed. The reason for it being is that we have another very big wave that's coming through, and also it's not only COVID-19, but the characteristics of the Japanese who tend to be very, very conservative, risk-prone, very much against the risk. And that's probably the reason why we're seeing a very negative connotation in regards to, very unfortunately, in regards to this Olympics.
South Korea reports a daily record of nearly 1,800 coronavirus cases as the country is grappling with a new surge. The rise is driven by the Delta variant that makes up 40% of the cases. However, mortality rate remains significantly low, with an average of 2 daily deaths. One-third of the country's 52 million population has received one dose of a coronavirus vaccine. The government aims to vaccinate 70% by September. Elsewhere in India, the country has added over 42,000 new infections to its COVID-19 total. Some 4,000 more people have also died of the virus over the past 24 hours. India's infection tally stands at over 31 million, with an overall death toll 418,000. Our correspondent, Manohar Zaman, says the rising number of COVID-19 cases in India is directly linked to the absence of public attention to health protocols.
Over the past two or three days, we're seeing numbers rising again. Well, there are lots of reasons behind that, but at the same time, the biggest state of Maharashtra is showing a greatest number of cases because that is the financial capital of India, where people from all across the states come into work. Now, why is there a rise in number of cases is due to the fact that people always tend to relax after the wave is over. They don't follow the government protocols. They don't follow the guidelines. And they start getting back to the normal routine when even the Prime Minister and the government officials warned that this is not the end of the pandemic. This is despite the fact many people have been vaccinated. Some of them have received the first vaccination, while others have received both. And in many cases and in many instances, we have seen patients, we have seen people, despite receiving both the vaccination, they have got the COVID. The rural parts of the country are still reeling by there. We always keep an eye on the urban hinterland. We have seen in the couple of months that bodies are being drowned to the rivers in Yamuna. At the same time, there were mass graves on the banks of Ganges.
Australia's new COVID-19 cases keep surging despite restrictions that have affected over half of the country. New South Wales state reported 110 new cases after being into a lockdown to contain the Delta variant outbreak for nearly 4 weeks. Also, the state of Victoria registered its biggest spike in the number of cases this month with 22 new infections. That's while it has been under a statewide lockdown for almost 2 weeks. Currently, over 13 million Australians are under stay-at-home orders. The country has so far reported a total of 32,000 cases and more than 900 deaths since the start of the pandemic. And France has criticized a move by Turkish Cypriot authorities to reopen the abandoned Cypriot resort town of Varosha, calling it a provocation. A spokesman for the French Foreign Ministry says Jean-Yves Le Drian discussed the issue with his Cypriot counterpart and will raise the issue at the UN. Earlier, the UN condemned Ankara's move as a breach of international law. Turkey, however, has dismissed the bloc's criticism as null and void. Varosha has been deserted since the 1974 war split Cyprus between the Greek Cypriot-run Republic of Cyprus and the self-declared Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. The town has remained a controversial issue among the two as UN efforts to bring peace to the island have so far failed. United Nations resolutions call for Varosha to be handed over to UN administration and to allow its Greek Cypriot residents to return. And divisions deepen within the European Union over claims that several of the bloc's member states continue to flout the rule of law. Poland and Hungary have been singled out for particular criticism in the European Commission's annual rule of law report. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
Poland's Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki and the EU's executive arm, the European Commission, are on a collision course. The Commission is demanding that Warsaw adheres to a recent EU Court of Justice ruling that Poland's disciplinary procedure for judges violates EU law.
We will ask for financial sanctions if Poland does not remedy the situation by the 16th of August. Let me repeat that we have said many times, EU law has primacy over national law.
The Commission has just published its 2021 EU Rule of Law report. It highlights concerns surrounding justice systems and corruption. The Commission says it's examining allegations that EU member Hungary has used spyware to hack into the phones of those criticizing Viktor Orban's government.
We will use all the possible tools to receive more information on this. So, of course, at the internal level with the different services of the Commission, we are starting, you mentioned, investigations. We are starting to collect information.
Other EU countries criticized in the rule of law report include Bulgaria, Croatia, and Slovenia. Recently, Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša participated in the annual conference of the MKO terrorist organization, sometimes referred to as the MEK. The terrorist group wants to oust the democratically elected government in Iran. The group is mainly funded by Saudi Arabia and Israel. Critics say the EU is quick to apply sanctions on foreign nations over alleged rule of law breaches, but is very slow to take action when some of its own 27 member states flout basic standards. The Commission's annual rule of law report repeatedly highlights the importance of media freedom. It's ironic because the EU's closest ally, the United States, continues to block .com media outlets operated from Iran, including PressTV.com. However, people can still log on using PressTV.ir. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Tensions have been growing between China and the West over disputed waters of the South China Sea. Earlier in our News Review program, we discussed the recent deployments in the strategic waterways and the maritime claims of different sides. Let's take a listen. News Review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, the UK says it will permanently deploy two warships to disputed waters in the South China Sea amid growing tensions between Beijing and the West. During a joint announcement with his Japanese counterpart, British Defense Minister Ben Wallace said the deployment will take place later this year. Wallace added that Britain will also sail a carrier strike through strike group through the Chinese claimed waters in September. China and a number of other Asian countries, including Vietnam and the Philippines, lay overlapping claims on the strategic waterway. In the past months, tensions have flared between Beijing and the West over the issue. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Ahmed Caballo, our correspondent, joining us from the British capital, London, and also joining us from Hong Kong, we have international and independent China strategist, Mr. Andrew K.P. Loring. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Ahmed in London. Ahmed, tell us more about this announcement from Britain.
So this is the latest stage in what people are calling the new Cold War, which is tensions between the People's Republic of China and the West, principally the United Kingdom, France, and the United States. And so what the UK is claiming, that it's going to deploy these ships to support its allies in the region, Philippines and Japan. But what many people think this is about is actually painting China as this big, bad bogeyman so that it can sell more weapons to Japan and Philippines. Japan already has the largest deployment of US troops outside of the United States, and it's clear it's clearly a susceptible nation when it comes to these new Cold War games. And this is part of the post-Brexit strategy for the UK to expand its influence throughout the world and try to regain its place as a big player on the global stage. Now, it says that it's doing this to support its allies, but this is clearly an antagonistic and aggressive move, because these are disputed waters. It is called the South China Sea, so clearly China has a very legitimate claim to the disputed waters in the South China Sea. The clue's in the name, after all. So for the UK to do this, it's a very aggressive move. And if you to think, if China was to do the reverse and deploy naval ships off the British Channel or off the Straits of Gibraltar, it would cause uproar and outrage here in the United Kingdom. So you got to ask yourself, why is it okay for the UK to do it in reverse?
Andrew Loring in Hong Kong, give us your thoughts on the issue. Ahmed in London believes that this is an aggressive act on behalf of the United Kingdom, and also they may want to be trying to insert themselves in this quote-unquote new modern-day Cold War.
Well, I think that the so-called Cold War is really started by the United States, which sees China as a emerging challenger to its global dominance as China grows stronger and also more influential in the economy and other state power. But as rightly pointed out just now, the South China Sea, of course, is an important conduit of China's economic lifeblood, transporting goods and services for its trade, on which China depends hugely for the survival of his the communist regime, it would be China's interest to keep this sea lane of communication as open as possible. So this rhetoric about freedom of navigation is a bit ironic, to say the least. Now, as far as the UK is concerned, of course, one must remember the United Kingdom is no longer the British Empire that it was. I don't think that the British people would view very kindly the United Kingdom's overstretching itself, its military projection, as it were, thousands of miles away from Britain, when Britain is now facing its uncertain future after Brexit. And of course, after Brexit, it's in Britain's interest to form closer trade relations with China rather than reverse. So I think that this kind of deployment of ships to the Chao-China Sea by Britain is more in the form of playing to the gallery, as it were, to the United States, saying that, okay, the UK is still the United States' closest ally. But when push comes to the show, I don't think that the British Navy would like to be involved in a hot war.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Ahmed Kabbal, our correspondent, joining us from the British capital, London. Also, thanks to Andrew K.P. Loing speaking to us from Hong Kong. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here. Moving on, 12 people have been killed and several others injured by record rainfall in China's central province of Henan in the provincial capital, Zhengzhou. Some 200,000 people were evacuated to safe zones. Weather forecasters say the torrential rains are the heaviest China's witnessed in 1,000 years. The deadly floods paralyzed Henan's transportation systems, affected dams, and upended the lives of millions of people. President Xi Jinping called the situation in Henan extremely severe and at a critical stage. He said flood prevention efforts there have been extremely difficult. The heavy rain started in Henan on Saturday and are expected to continue for the next 3 days. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Eid al-Adha, or Feast of the Sacrifice, is a major Islamic holiday celebrating the willingness of Prophet Abraham, peace be upon him, to sacrifice his firstborn son Ishmael as an act of obedience to God's command. We here at Arabi English Radio congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Eid al-Adha, the Feast of Sacrifice. Eid Mubarak.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. Some people focus too much on pointless matters and make wrong analysis. Thankfully, the election was held, and I hope it will be a blessed one in the end. During the election, certain things were witnessed that one should keep as experience and that one should learn from. Later on, the Iranian nation should draw on these lessons. Potential candidates' belief in solutions for the problems of the country. Well, a variety of opinions and tastes were seen in the televised debates. But all those honorable candidates agreed unanimously that the country's economic problems have a solution. This is the exact opposite of what the enemy wants to say, that there is no solution. Everyone agreed that there is a solution, but each candidate believed that their own solution was right. However, all of them denied the existence of a dead end. This is a very important matter. Presidential candidates behave in a moral and ethical manner. Of course, during these debates, some people spoke in defense of the positions of the revolution with the necessary politeness and religious manners. Some also showed some instances of bad behavior, which is unfortunate because we should not witness such behavior. We should not follow the lead of the United States in politics and in elections. We should not learn from Trump and Biden, who insulted each other in their debates. These are not good examples and they should not be looked at. America's disastrous elections. In the eyes of the whole world, the election held by the enemies of Iran, the United States, was a scandalous election. They really did an awful job. Now the same scoundrels are criticizing our election. An American element commented on the Iranian election. Despite the scandal on their own plates, they have found their tongues after several months and speak against our elections. However, with the scandal that they crafted, they should not say a single word about any elections.
On July 19, 2019, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps detained the UK-flagged oil tanker Stena Impero in the Strait of Hormuz, a channel that links the Persian Gulf with the Oman Sea and the Indian Ocean. In a statement, the IRGC said the Swedish-owned vessel had been impounded with its 23 crew members aboard at the request of the Ports and Maritime Organization of Hormuzgan Province for failing to respect international maritime rules. The British tanker had violated the maritime regulations by switching off its tracking systems. It also disregarded the established procedures by making an entry from the exit point of the Strait of Hormuz in the south instead of Northern Pass. The oil tanker was then escorted to Iran's Bandar Abbas port for further legal procedures and investigations. The head of Hormozgan Ports and Maritime Organization said Stena Impero ignored distress calls as it collided with a fishing boat on its route.
The vessel, to avoid inspections that we must have conducted in this collision incident, changed its route. This jeopardized the safety of shipping lanes in the region and gravely violated international regulation on passage in marine areas. Accordingly, the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' naval forces guided the vessel to harbor at the port city of Bandar Abbas for inspection as well as technical investigation of the circumstances, effects, and causes of the incident in accordance with international regulations.
Tensions escalated between Iran and the UK following the seizure of Stena Impero. Britain described the seizure as a dangerous act and called for the release of the vessel.
We need to see the illegal seizing of a British-flagged vessel reversed. We need that ship released. And we continue to be very concerned about the safety and welfare of the 23 crew members.
However, Iran said the seizure of the British vessel was legal. It said collisions happen in the Strait of Hormuz, but regulations require those involved to respond to regional authorities' inquiries. After 2 months in detention, Iran's inquiry into the tanker's conduct was completed and a resolution to the matter was reached. Stena Impero set sail in September and left Iranian waters for Dubai, putting an end to 2 months of row. In early June, British Marines assisted Gibraltar to seize an Iranian supertanker off the southern coast of Spain. Gibraltar's officials claimed the ship was transporting crude oil to Syria in violation of EU sanctions imposed on Damascus. Moreover, Britain defended the seizure of Iran's supertanker as a legal move. Meanwhile, Washington praised the move and hailed it as a sign of Europe acting along the line of US unilateral sanctions against Tehran. However, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif slammed the detainment of Iran's tanker and described it as piracy, adding that the objective behind Iran's actions was to uphold international maritime rule. Also, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran would respond to Britain's piracy over the seizure of an Iranian oil tanker in Gibraltar.
So it's an unbelievable arrogance on the part of the Western powers, but then they've been demonstrating that for most of the 20th century and all of this century.
U.S. sanctions on Iran's oil, U.K. seizure of Iranian supertanker, and sabotage operations on oil ships are all instances of the West's actions that have caused turmoil in the international energy market. Add to this list the economic warfare waged by Israel against Iran. A Wall Street Journal report in March revealed that Israel had systematically struck at least 12 Iranian ships. However, Iran has time and again shown its adversaries that their illegal acts in the Persian Gulf will not be left unanswered.
The discovery of an unmarked graveyard at a former residential school run by the Catholic Church in the Canadian province of British Columbia in May, which contained at least 215 human remains, mostly young children, prompted an outpouring of grief and anger and a wider investigation into similar boarding schools that were open from the late 19th century to the mid-1990s. The probes have so far found some 1,100 bodies at the sites of former residential schools in the provinces of British Columbia and Saskatchewan. A Canadian researcher whose works contributed to the uncovering of the first mass grave has said the discoveries so far have barely scratched the surface. The residential school system in Canada was established in 1883 under the country's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald. The aim was to assimilate Indigenous peoples in Canada and destroy their languages and culture. By the 1920s, attending residential schools had been made mandatory for children aged between 7 and 15.
But these have been going on for years. The residential school survivors just basically were ignored. Now today, it seems a shock to some people, but it shouldn't be a shock because this was known that it was the policy in Canada. It was also the policy in the United States. It is pulling these kids out of their homes, and they wanted to indoctrinate them. And that's exactly what they tried to do.
Some 150,000 children were separated from their parents, often under threats of persecution. The first mass grave in British Columbia was found after Indigenous elders recollected the memories of young children digging holes in the ground. The survivors have told harrowing stories of how the mistreatment and abuse the children were subjected to at the former residential schools led some to attempt suicide or try to escape.
Many of our children who ran away during the winter and froze to death on their way home. And the quilts, the black robes, start lying about the children. Oh yeah, they're doing fine here. In the meantime, they were missing. And no one had searched for them.
A former student of the Cooper Island Industrial School has described the place as Canada's Alcatraz. In a 2015 report, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada called the practices employed in the former schools, quote, cultural genocide.
We're trying to say, people trying to say now, cultural genocide, as if it doesn't fit in the description of the word genocide as defined by the United Nations. And it's very clear that that's what they did.
These are the hard truths that are part of Canada's history. These are the hard truths we must confront as a society.
The Canadian government has vowed to fulfill the Indigenous people's demands to fund investigations into the graves around the country, but it's come under criticism for failing to do so earlier, as the discoveries made so far have been funded by the Indigenous groups themselves. The First Nations leaders say over 6,000 children died at the schools from causes like disease, accident, and suicide, but there's no clear picture of how many children lost their lives throughout the years. That means there will be more headlines about mass graves discoveries around Canada in the months to come.
The United Arab Emirates is among a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States and condemned by Palestinians. The Emiratis, who have been particularly open about their ongoing normalization process, opened an embassy in Israel this week.
The UAE has never been known for having an independent foreign policy. It has never stood for the rights of Palestinian people. Historically and recently, as you have seen, the UAE has always aligned its foreign policy with the foreign policy objectives of Western countries like the US and UK.
The new embassy is located in the heart of Israel's financial hub, Tel Aviv's Stock Exchange building. This is seen by many as a sign that the two sides are highlighting the role of economic cooperation in their normalization of ties. Last month, Israel opened an embassy in the Emirati capital Abu Dhabi and a consulate in the UAE's business hub Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals, ranging from financial services to tourism. Critics say Emirati leaders have totally abandoned the Palestinian cause for the economic and political dividends of ties with the Israeli regime. The controversial normalization process is very much ongoing, despite Palestinian anger. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stances adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinian movement Hamas says this week's embassy opening, quote, marks an insistence on the great sin against the people of Palestine and all the nations of the region. It warned that the move would encourage the regime to press ahead with its crimes in the occupied territories and in the besieged Gaza Strip. Observers warn that the embassy opening, just weeks after Israel's deadly onslaught against the Gaza Strip and the escalation of the regime's violations in the occupied West Bank, indicates that some Arab states are no longer bound by the Palestinian cause. Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel. The Palestinian issue was once a unifying cause among Arab countries. But Israel, backed by the United States, has apparently managed to divide them more than ever. Israel has been especially thankful to the United States for pushing the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan to normalize their ties with the regime. America has always been a staunch ally of Israel, but former U.S. President Donald Trump was perhaps the best friend of the Israelis in a very long time. His extremely pro-Israel decisions and policies are still impacting the lives of people in the West Asia region, especially those in Palestine. The Palestinians say they have come to the conclusion that America's heavily biased stance leaves no room for any further U.S. mediation role regarding Palestine in the future.
As protests continue in Cuba, Iran has warned against any foreign interference in its internal affairs. Tehran has urged an end to Washington's unilateral sanctions on the Caribbean nation. The Iranian Foreign Ministry also highlighted the economic hardships caused by decades of U.S. measures against Cuba, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. Iran says the U.S. is the root cause of many of the problems in Cuba. In a blatant violation of international law, Washington continues to express support for protests in Cuba and seeks to meddle in its affairs. Meanwhile, the Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez has held the U.S. responsible for stirring up violence in Cuba, saying that Washington is using high-tech digital systems to incite protests in the Caribbean island nation. Rodriguez has said that Washington sought to generate disorder and instability to fracture the constitutional order and social consensus in Cuba. He condemned the campaign promoted from U.S. soil through social media to promote riots and destabilizing acts, warning that such irresponsible conduct could have negative implications for the region and even harm the national interests of the U.S.
The United States has, since the 60s, been interfering in the internal affairs of Cuba, beginning with the Bay of Pigs. They launched not only an invasion of Cuba, but also tried to create paramilitaries there. And in doing so, they also set up a blockade, which affected the internal and the domestic economy of Cuba and had a long-lasting impact for over six decades, costing hundreds of billions of dollars.
A large-scale anti-Cuba communication operation had been underway since June 23, when Havana presented the report, Necessity of Ending the Economic, Commercial, and Financial Blockade Imposed by the United States of America on Cuba at the UN General Assembly. The operation includes calls for violence, aggression against the authorities, and the assassination of leaders.
A lot of these attempts have ended up failing, but these are all attempts to really strangle the nation and strangle really the civilians. And it's very hypocritical of the United States, who's now decrying interference from foreign countries like Russia or China, to have this history with interfering with other nations like Cuba, but also outside of Cuba throughout Latin America.
Protest rallies erupted against the Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel's government over the weekend. Thousands took to the streets in major cities, demanding his resignation amid a worsening economic crisis. The unrest comes at a time when Cuba is going through its worst economic crisis in 30 years, with chronic shortages of electricity and food, exacerbated by hefty U.S. sanctions.
There are difficult times due to circumstances, including the blockade, including the pandemic, which is already causing difficulty on the island for many of the people. And the U.S. is continuing to add to that difficulty by continuing these illegal sanctions. And again, it's not just the case for Cuba. We can go to Venezuela.
The Cuban government blames the economic woes mainly on U.S. sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. has maintained a harsh economic, financial, and commercial embargo against Cuba for more than 60 years. Numerous resolutions by the U.N. General Assembly have indicated that the blockade is against international law. The social media campaign directed against Cuba is reminiscent of many other regime change programs directed by the U.S.
It was just recently that the U.N. voted against the U.S. embargo, with only two countries voting against that resolution. That was the U.S. and Israel, while over 180 countries voted to end the illegal embargo or blockade against Cuba. Yet despite these votes, which have been occurring, you know, every few years or so, the U.S. continues with this blockade,
including the 2019 coup d'etat against the Bolivian President Evo Morales and an attempted coup against President Maduro in Venezuela. The U.S. has recently further tightened the illegal embargo under the pretext of fighting the spread of the coronavirus. Many Cubans have grown frustrated with the economic crisis and a surge in coronavirus cases. Although the current U.S. President Joe Biden had pledged during his presidential campaign to reverse some of Trump's brutal sanctions measured against Cuba, he has yet to remove any of the sanctions imposed by the former Republican president.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity,
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We were looking at some of the examples when it comes to United Nations and their human rights charter being applied in real life. So we took the example of Iraq. Among the example that we also can talk about Iraq, that when we talk about intervention, when another country is being manipulated by another power and being abused by another power under the pretext of a human rights, because why would we go to another country? Well, because we're trying to save humanity from what? Because this country possesses nuclear powers, for example, nuclear weapons. So we're trying to get rid of them so we can save the humanity, even though they themselves have hundreds and hundreds of nuclear warheads. So with them, it's okay, because we're good people, we're the good guys, and we will only use our rockets against the bad guys. But we will not allow anyone else to have, because they could be the bad guys at one time. It's just, I don't know, it's just a very stupid, sick ideology. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make here is that when they intervene in another country, there's always losses. There will always be losses on different levels, right? On the social level, on the economical level, on the political level, and so on and so on. Like, it would have devastating effects on these levels of society. And the one that ends up suffering the most are people, right? So first, you can have people dying. So, for example, in the war on Iraq, in the first Gulf War, according to the studies, they said about 24,000 people, civilians, mind you, 24,865 civilians got killed in the first 2 years of the sanction on Iraq and the war in Iraq. And it just created havoc. Right, and then they created the sectarian division between the country itself, which made people kill themselves based on sectarianism and based on faith. And also thousands and thousands of people lost their lives. And mind you, when I say lost their lives, this is, you know, we're talking about from infants all the way to old people, and males and females alike. And the statistics in this regard are scary if one reads it and see how many people got killed during the intervention of the Americans in the first Gulf War and even the second Gulf War and the sectarian that happened in Iraq. Only why? Because they were subjected to this unfair sanctions and just getting involved in the politics, getting involved in their lives, getting involved in their system, because they felt it was a threat to them. Or maybe because they had interests of their own they wanted to satisfy and they wanted to take. And people fell victim to that. So you can see that always when another country intervenes in another country's politics or life, people are the first to be victims to it. So hundreds of thousands died since the Gulf War until now. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people lost their lives because America decided to do something that they thought, well, it is for the best or the betterment of humankind, and we're trying to preserve human rights. So, yeah, sure, kill 100,000, kill a million people, because I want to save, I don't know, 100 million. This concept, even though it's like it's sick in its nature, but yet it's being practiced despite the fact that they still say we are the champions of human rights and we try to preserve human rights. Now, don't go anywhere. Let us take a break and then we continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. So we were looking at some of the examples that happens when a country gets sanctioned or gets threatened or even gets invaded by another superpower or by another country under the pretext of trying to preserve human rights. So we said in Iran, for example, they're trying to say, well, Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, even though they knew that they had nothing. The loss of human life was staggering. And most of the people that got killed, most of the people that died, were people from populated areas. So, for example, this is something that one needs really to consider, that why would an airplane or a jet fighter plane goes to a city or a populated area or even a village and bombard it with rockets and kill hundreds of people and thousands of people, where they know for a fact there's not a single soldier in these villages or these cities, because they're just cities. They're not an army base. Why would you do that? Where is the humanity in that? And we can see the same thing happens today in Palestine, for example, where Israel, with their jet fighters, they go to Gaza and they bombard buildings where people are living. We see the same thing happens in Yemen, for example. You see the Saudis, they go into Yemen and bombarding them with bombs and killing civilians. Where is the human right here? So Saudi Arabia claims to be the champions of human rights. They're always talking about human rights, and we support the human rights and so on and so forth. Yet they are killing, so far they killed thousands and thousands of Muslims and innocent people. And in Palestine, thousands and thousands have been killed so far. In Iraq, thousands and thousands have been killed. And so on and so forth. And this is all happening under the umbrella of the United Nations. Obviously, they have the green light by the United Nations, because we don't see the United Nations stopping them or trying to intervene or trying to send the NATO army to, you know, stop the war. In fact, they're just turning a blind eye. They just don't care. And recently we heard in the news that America said, well, if, you know, the United Nations, they wanted to have a sitting, right? They wanted to gather and discuss what's happening in Gaza and Palestine. America said, we will not allow such a gathering to take place. We will use the veto, the right of the veto, and we'll cancel such a gathering. And you can say, well, what are you guys doing? What is the human right in this? Why would you call yourself, you know, the defenders of human rights and the human right charter that you wrote? Yet under your umbrella, millions of people, thousands of people being killed, being massacred. Where Islam says a life of one person, that if you take that life, it is like you've taken the life of the entire humanity. So how many, you know, how many humanities have they killed so far? So if they kill 1,000, they would have killed everyone on earth 1,000 times. So they've been killing the human beings on earth millions of times over and over and over. Islam trying to preserve these rights and says, well, if you have an issue and you want to deal with it, even on a military scale, keep civilians away from it. As simple as it gets. Don't go killing civilians and then say it is for the sake and the betterment of human rights. Inshallah, we will continue in episodes to come. and till then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
The Weight of Chains Part 3.
In a few cases, however, the Hague Tribunal did manage to bring an indictment against Kosovo Albanians who were accused of committing crimes, like in the case of Ramush Haradinaj. Don't let the glasses fool you. Haradinaj was one ruthless KLA militant in the 1990s, accused of murdering Serbs, Roma, and even non-compliant Albanians during the Kosovo War.
We had a lot of difficulties to come to an end to the investigation against Haradinaj. But at the end, we achieved it. So we could issue an indictment against him, and this indictment was confirmed by a judge.
However, as the trial started and progressed, something strange happened.
Haradinaj was freed of all charge because a number of witnesses were killed. According to former Hague Tribunal prosecutor Karadet Ponte, 9 witnesses were killed between 2003 and 2007. So in such a situation, living witnesses are frightened and some of them refuse to testify, others change their testimony. The UN mission in Kosovo always refused to cooperate with the Hague Tribunal by refusing to send evidence of war crime.
It is understandable that NATO didn't want their KLA buddies in jail, but the largest single act of ethnic cleansing during the Yugoslav Wars, Operation Storm, in which Croat forces ethnically cleansed 250,000 Serbs from the Krajina region in Croatia, with thousands killed in cold blood, was perhaps the biggest test for the tribunal. General Ante Gotovina was in charge of that operation, and the Hague Tribunal put up an indictment. Gotovina was arrested and tried, and believe it or not, convicted.
First instance trial, he was convicted 23 years. So, evidences were there. Enough evidences to convict and to sentence him.
However, another strange thing happened here. The case quickly went to appeal, the previous sentence was overturned, and Gotovina was immediately released.
It was extremely damaging to Serbs in this case, you know. And killing in Operation Storm, they obliged the Serbs to leave Knin and so on and so on. So we prove it. In the first instance, the Gotovina was convicted. So why now on appeal this completely different decision?
You think it was more of a political decision?
You say it, and I must say yes, because I cannot believe it.
Ante Gotovina was given a hero's welcome in Croatia. But not all Croats believed in the Gotovina myth. This war profiteer, however, was a free man, with the blessing of the West. He played an important part in what the West really wanted. And when a nation has war profiteers as heroes, it's no wonder that as the fighting subsides, the system remains corrupt. Ivo Sanader ruled as Prime Minister of Croatia from 2003 to 2009, and under the mask of being a European Union-friendly statesman, bought people left and right. According to the Washington Times, Sanader turned Croatia into a gangster country, and by controlling most of the media, including state television and leading Croatian newspapers, he could make sure that the people only saw things his way. During his rule, Sanader amassed enormous wealth that included illegally acquired property, luxurious villas, and a lavish collection of watches worth over $200,000. After 6 years in power, Sanader decided to step down. Eventually, Sanader was arrested, put on trial, and sentenced to 10 years for his wrongdoings. However, the system remained corrupt, and the people of the former Yugoslavia could only hope that an honest, hard-working man would show up and fight against systemic corruption. He came in the form of a TV morning talk show guest. Ljubiša Milanović was appointed by former Serbian Health Minister Zoran Stanković to his anti-corruption division. He was the first state official to openly criticize the police, state prosecutors, and anti-corruption agency, claiming that they just weren't interested in helping him fight corruption. Yes, the cartoon